This is Ryan Boyle, and you're listening to Pro Lacrosse Talk.
Right off the bat, there's Lyle Thompson.
Courier.
Kylie O'Miller showing off those shifty skills.
Driver driving hard down the alley, and he scores.
What a goal from Josh Bird.
Kayla Trainer fires to score.
Are you kidding me? By Dylan Warren.
Gets topside. Rambo scores!
Welcome to Pro Lacrosse Talk on the Lacrosse Playground Podcast Network, your go-to podcast for interviews with professional players, coaches, and executives, as well as the latest news and analysis from all three professional lacrosse leagues. Now, here's your host, Hutton Jackson.
We're here with Ryan Boyle, four-time All-American and national champion at Princeton, four-time champion in the MLL, and PLL analyst during NBC's coverage of the PLL. Ryan, I know we want to speak to you, because of the draft, and I speak on behalf of Adam that we're really excited to have you on and break down this PLL college draft. But we do want to go back a little bit to your earlier playing days, you know, at Princeton, and then you getting drafted yourself into the MLL and NLL. So first off, again, welcome to the show, and let's talk a little bit about your time at Princeton and kind of how do you end up at Princeton.
And for the record, I said we could avoid all talk of me if you wanted just to do all PLL drafts. I'm just throwing that disclaimer. If people are like, great, I'm going to start hitting the fast forward button. But yeah, I'm happy to go back to the past and talk about Princeton and MLL and NLL and wherever you guys want to go.
Yeah, I mean, well, you're a four-time pro champion, so I think we have to at least highlight that a little bit for our audience. But yeah, let's first start at Princeton. You know, you're a four-time All-American. You won a championship there. You made it to the Final Four every year. You were there as well.
Not my junior year. We got knocked out. The quarterfinals as the higher seed.
So yeah, you want to start there. How brutal was it losing that game? And how did your career kind of set you up for your time in the pros as well?
That would probably be my least favorite memory or certainly in the memory bank of the dark memories. But we actually had a really talented team that year. We just got kind of riddled with injuries, myself included. And Cuse was actually a little down that year too. So it was really strange. I think if memory serves me correctly, we were the 4 seed and they were the 5 seed, but the Carrier Dome was selected as kind of one of the sites for the quarters. So we played, in essence, an away game at Syracuse, but as the home seed. So it was kind of bizarre on a lot of different fronts. We just didn't have enough juice. We were just kind of too kind of short-manned or kind of, like I said, riddled with injury. And it was... the game wasn't really even competitive. I remember distinctly, you know, having hamstring issues and barely kind of being able to walk. But the other seasons did make championship weekend, and certainly much more fond memories for sure.
Yeah, what about lifting, you know, that trophy and that championship with Princeton? What was that feeling like?
You know, I don't remember like specifically like holding the trophy. Mm-hmm. I do remember, you know, passing the ball to BJ Prager, who then scored the game winner in overtime, and just not knowing what to do, and like Forrest Gump style, I just started running. I just like didn't know where to go, where to be, you know, everything was just such a blur and just euphoria and like just whatever my momentum was, I just kind of like kept running. Kind of up near the right sideline, and next thing you know, kind of found Dan Clark, DC, and kind of, you know, jumped into his arms, and then the celebration was kind of on from there. But I can, you know, have a little bit of like an outer body experience and kind of get right back to that place, you know, mentally. Just I'm getting goosebumps right now. But then after that, like everything is just kind of blurry. Like I don't remember holding the trophy or like anything, but I can like get back to that specific moment pretty quickly.
You know, that must have been a tremendous moment. And then you got drafted, you know, both in the MLL and the NLL as well.
I actually got drafted by the Rochester Rattlers. It was actually pretty crafty by the Rattlers. So Mike Powell went 1, and then the Rattlers had picked 2 and 4. And the barrage was 3. And the barrage, we had Greg Cotrano as our goalie. Mm-hmm. Rochester, the Rattlers had a very specific need at goalie. And so, you know, conventional wisdom was they're going to take Tillman Johnson there. And then I would kind of be, you know, ready for the barrage to take. And the barrage had a very specific need, the position I played. And Rochester kind of crafty moves. They took me too, thinking the barrage would then pass on Tillman because they had Catrano, and then they would take, you know, and then the Rattlers would be able to get Tillman at four. And then Philly ended up, you know, kind of calling the Rattlers bluff, drafted Tillman three. And so I was involved in actually, you know, I don't know if it happened later that day. I was actually out of the country in Japan with the Princeton team. So I didn't really learn any of this until later. But then I was involved in a draft day trade. So Philly and Rochester, me, Tillman, and then I'm blanking on who else was kind of involved in it. And then, involved in the trade, and then Rochester ended up taking Sean Lindsay, you know, another, you know, fantastic player with a great college and pro career at four.
Yeah, so a little bit of draft day drama, and we can get a little bit into the PLO drama that we had too a little bit later. But talk to me a little bit about that first seasons, both in the field and box game. Like I mentioned, you were rookie of the year in both those leagues, which I don't think many people have done. You know, I don't know. I have to do a little bit more research on to see who else has done that. But I have to imagine you're at least, you know, one of a few to do that. So talk a little bit about, you know, adjusting to the pro game.
Well, I think, you know, the adjustment to Philadelphia was fairly seamless, just because they really kind of had an open spot at my position and a need to a degree. Not to say they didn't have, you know, great players, you know, on their team, but it was kind of a specific need. And it was pretty seamless, just because I also had, you know, some teammates that I was pretty comfortable with, kind of heading into it, you know, most notably, you know, BJ, whom I already mentioned, BJ Prager, and then, you know, Matt Strebel, just to name two. And so they kind of knew what I was all about, knew in terms of playing style, but, you know, as importantly, just kind of personality. And so they kind of really welcomed me and the team, and, you know, I give the head coach Sal Acacio a ton of credit, just in terms of really empowering me, and despite a lot of veterans kind of speaking up, you know, about kind of my role within the team. And you know, for anybody that knows me, you know, I'm not the shyest when it comes to like how things should how the game should be played, and how the offense and defense should kind of complement each other. And trying to like not lose sight of like the goal is to win the game. And so anything that would pop into my mind in terms of like how we're going to accomplish that, like, you know, I maybe waited a week or two, before then kind of, you know, speaking my mind. You know, the NLL was a totally different ball of wax. And I really made it a point to come with a very humble approach, and with the mindset of just like, I'm using the same skill sets that I've always used, but I've got to like learn kind of a new version of the sport. And so I never acted as though, you know, I was going to have a ton of success or was going to play field, you know, in box. So I really tried to come to training camp with an open mind, and was really fortunate to have an organization and some very key veteran players that did not mind teaching me. And hopefully I reflected that back, that I was open to be taught and willing to be coached, and was very fortunate just to have an organization that was, you know, willing to take a bet on an American player and give him a little bit of time and space to learn, and the breathing room to make some mistakes and not have kind of a quick yank kind of off the field. And so was very, very fortunate to end up in that situation. And I think to earn kind of rookie of the year probably speaks more about my draft class than you know, me personally, but really enjoyed acclimating to the style of game and the culture, and just incredibly thankful for the opportunity.
You know, and in terms of championships, we mentioned you've won four in the MLL, you know, three with the Barrage, which you guys were essentially probably the first field lacrosse dynasty in professional lacrosse, you would say. And then you won another one with the Cannons as well, who retired your jersey. Let's talk a little bit about that last one. And, you know, moving on from the Barrage to the Cannons, And, you know, being with that organization and now seeing that organization join the PLL this upcoming season.
Yeah, it was a strange transition, just because, you know, you've got these relationships and you've got kind of all these experiences built up. And so there's kind of a trust factor built in, and not only, you know, built over times on the field, but just as importantly, you know, hanging off the field and, you know, grabbing dinner or hanging with guys in the off season. And so it really was having to like redo that kind of all over again. I remember kind of showing up and it was like, am I adjusting to you or are you adjusting to me? And, you know, like most things in life, there's a little bit of give and take kind of on both sides. But I think, you know, once that learning curve was kind of over and then that's when we were able to see, you know, a lot of success, but it didn't come without kind of its trials and tribulations, so to speak, early on, just because, you know, while these teammates, they used to be my opponents, they didn't know about close games that the barrage had against, you know, a different opponent, and we, you know, and certain players stepping up or playing roles in certain things. So it was almost like a complete reset to a degree of just kind of having to build up that same kind of equity, if you will, with your teammates and with your coaches and with the organization as a whole, in terms of, you know, valuing, you know, my opinion, me valuing theirs, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and talk about the satisfaction of winning, you know, in 2011. It was the franchise's first championship, and obviously your fourth. What was that feeling like?
You know, it was a really special moment to bring a championship to you know, such a franchise held in such a high esteem. You know, one of the flagship franchises in the league that had come so close, but never been able to get over that hurdle. And you know, the weekend itself, you know, we played the Saturday in like a monsoon, like standing water, hurricane. We were down early and big. And so I remember, you know, specifically, you know, coming back and tying the game and just, you know, looking around the huddle and just being like, hey, like, remove the emotion that we just went through to get to this point. Like, it's tied. Like, we now need to like, just everybody just, we've worked so hard to get to this point. Like, take a deep breath. We're right there, but like, it's a different game now. It's tied. We've worked so hard. Like, let's not lose the focus of like, we're now in a tie game. And you know, fortunately, you know, made some plays down the stretch. Max Quinzani made kind of an all-time kind of catch and finish to win the game, and really on a poor pass, like it was a bounce pass in standing water. So how he was able to corral that and then get that on net is, you know, speaks to the beauty of Max Quinzani's game. And then in the finals, it was really understanding that Jordan Burke was the MVP of that weekend. And it was clear that he was the best player in my mind, kind of on the field. And that our defense was the critical component. And so you need to have a certain level of self-awareness and assessment of your own team and how you're going to win the game. And understand that really what we need to do offensively, we're going to be fine. We're going to put up the necessary numbers, but what we can't do is jeopardize our defense, because when they are put in a situation to succeed, they're going to win the game for us. And so, you know, my mindset really kind of shifted to like, we need to make sure that offensively we're protecting our defense, because if they're put in an advantageous situation, they're going to win the game for us. And so knowing that mindset, accepting that mindset as an offensive player, that your defense is going to win that, it then affects kind of how you're going to play offensively. And I just thought that given the play of Jordan Burke and Cage and the defense that we had in front of them, we had to kind of take that mindset and then execute accordingly.
No, I was actually at that game. You know, it was a nail biter, 10-9, I think was the final in that game. But yeah, I think it was pretty cool to see, you know, the Cannons hoist that trophy for the first time, and they just hoisted it in the MLL last year. But now they're kind of, again, the new kids on the block, kind of out to prove something, I think, in the PLL. But I want to transition now to kind of the coaching side of things, because you are a founder of Trilogy. You're the CEO. Talk a little bit about how you got into the coaching game and what's it like training the next generation of players.
Yeah, so I think when I graduated, you know, I'd already been in the industry for, you know, close to 10 years, mm-hmm. Just in terms of, you know, working at overnight camps, day camps, clinics, things like that. And so, you know, we started running events before we like technically had a company, whether it was with a friend or just kind of like getting the necessary insurance, but not really having like a full structure of a company and in a very kind of innocuous manner. And, you know, it became clear to me quite quickly that, you know, what we were doing from a curriculum and training perspective was really better than anything I had been to as a staff member. So, call it hubris, call it naivety. It was like, you know, there's this, the sport is really exploding across the country and there's all this growth and there isn't the education to kind of keep up with it. And so that was really kind of how we got our start, was, you know, developing educational programming, there'd be camps day, overnight, clinics, coaching seminars, things of that nature. And really just hitting the ground running and really taking a grassroots approach. And, you know, remember the first couple of years, just traveling nonstop in order to just develop relationships and see where there was need, see where there was appetite, see there was an interest in working with us. And from there really kind of built our base of network and relationships of whether it be, regions, states, cities, programs that mm-hmm. were interested, you know, in what we provided from an education standpoint. And then from there, really, really kind of organic growth in terms of adding people, adding the right people. You know, most notably, you know, Mitch Belisle, who's still with us. We kind of make a joke, like we don't know how long Mitch has kind of been around. And then really kind of evolving, you know, our programming to larger scale events where we could have, you know, a bigger kind of macro impact on the game and providing players and teams the opportunity to train and get the instruction that they need. And then also, you know, compete at events that are well run. And then also, you know, introducing college coaches from both an education standpoint, you know, mm-hmm. with regards to, you know, on the field and off the field in terms of, you know, recruiting education and then, you know, providing players with exposure to play at the next level.
No, I think that's great. And it's, you know, so important, I think, too, as the sport continues to grow, to have that education that, you know, is coming from, you know, the premier players from the sport too, because, you know, as you have growth, you have growing pains sometimes where there maybe not be the education that needs to be. And I think that's why it's important what you guys are doing. Let's segue a little bit into your broadcast career. You are an analyst with the NBC team that covers the PLL. You also were part of the draft coverage the past couple of years, including on Monday night. So let's go into the draft. First off, you know, what were your main takeaways, I guess, from the draft? I mean, in my opinion, I think every team kind of filled the needs that they had, if there were any really needs going into it. A lot of teams were, I feel like, pretty stacked already. But what are some key takeaways from this PLL college draft that you had?
So it's still a bit of a blur. So I'm just going to admit that. It's still a bit of a blur and I'm still kind of processing everything. And I got to like put the draft picks in the rosters and like mm-hmm. how they form. But, you know, I think some main takeaways, you just said it and I said it on the broadcast, but, you know, there's a lot of coaches kind of patting themselves on the back. You know, there was, you know, pretty much, you know, almost to a team, I laid out some team needs and I'm, you know, as the night goes through, I'm just a lot of check marks, mm-hmm. lot of check marks. And I think that speaks to, you know, the depth of the class. So the ability to slot in some seemingly very productive players, you know, for mm-hmm. those team needs. So I think that's one of my main takeaways. You know, again, not be too repetitive, but I think the Redwoods getting TD at number four, the fact that he, for lack of better words, dropped to them is, you know, you got to be feeling good if you're Nat St. Laurent and a Redwoods fan, just in terms of, you know, that was such a huge need for them and to get, mm-hmm. you know, arguably the top guy coming out, not only in this class, like, but in recent memory, right, mm-hmm. Is certainly a win. And then you look at the two teams that had, you know, just an influx of picks, the Chaos and the Atlas, just in terms of remaking their rosters. I thought the Chaos kind of took some swings for the fences, so to mm-hmm. speak. And I thought the Atlas did a really good job of kind of rounding out remaking really a significant part of their roster and two areas specifically kind of on the offensive half with, mm-hmm. with playmakers and then their short stick defensive midfield. But you know, I could keep going in terms of the team mm-hmm. kind of, you know, filled some needs, but you know, in terms of, you know, biting my tongue and having a conversation here, those are probably the places I would start. And I think the mm-hmm. big like draft kind of, you know, every draft has kind of a wrench thrown in there. Mm-hmm. And I think it was, you know, at number three, JT Giles-Harris, not that he isn't worthy of that number three pick. I'm certainly not saying that, but when he went three, that then had the Redwoods take TD at four. And now you kind of opened up kind of a lot of offensive players that might not have been available or then Connors and then offensive mm-hmm. players. And then, you know, I thought the Cannons would take a defenseman at nine, which they did. They took Keelty. So then it's kind of a chain reaction. JT yep. Giles there's at three, then Keelty at nine. And so that's when you saw, you know, a bunch of coaches, you know, most notably, and the best, you know, one of the best sound bites was Tim Sudan, I think, laughing about getting Tarafenko.
Yeah.
There was just some guys that are like, this guy's available? Like, really? Like, yeah. Okay. Like, didn't think he'd be here. So those are kind of some of my major takeaways.
Yeah, I think that speaks to the draft class as well. And I was probably a little bit less surprised about JT Giles-Harris, but I don't think people realize how close the Chrome were to possibly taking TD. Because, you know, Connor Farrell's a pretty solid faceoff guy himself, but I think, you know, they thought that highly enough of TD that they were considering using their pick on him. But obviously with Tom Rigney's military commitments, it made a lot of sense for them to go with JT Giles-Harris. But talk a little bit about, too, like this draft trade scenario. We mentioned you were a part of one when you were drafted, but the Eli Gobrecht trade, I think, took a lot of people for a whirlwind, and it kind of had a ripple effect as well. Talk a little bit about that trade that you know, Coach Copeland pulled off.
Yeah, I think it's more about the Archers. So I think once they got Connors, because, you know, on their roster, and there's been a little rumble of like, you've already got Ratliff, but like they didn't really have, I think, a second pull there. And so they were kind of going to have to piecemeal together that second pull. And you know, Ratliff is a tremendous player, but having a number two just to spell him, you know, and to give him a little bit of breather, or having the flexibility to double pull. They didn't really have that per se. They had some guys at close that they could maybe bump up. And so, you know, I had LSM depth as kind of one of their needs. I think once Connors kind of fell into their lap, they take him, and now they don't need to flex a close guy. Mm-hmm. So you look at their close guy, and it's like, okay, do we want depth here? Or now is one of those, you know, close guys, you know, for lack of better words, expendable. Mm-hmm. And so you have that on the Archer side, and then on the Water Dog side, you know, close D was a clear area for need for them. And it's like, okay, well, do we want to take a rookie at, you know, what was it? Pick 18, I think, maybe mm-hmm. even lower.
I believe so. Yeah.
Was it 18?
Yeah, it was 18. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, you know, am I going to draft a guy at 18 and feel good about inserting him in the starting lineup, or am I going to take, you know, a proven veteran in Gobrecht? And so I think that's where kind of the two sides came together.
Yeah, no. And I think it's interesting too, because the Archers were kind of put in that situation kind of it was a good problem to have, but because I think they got Hossack in that entry draft right. and didn't expect to get Warren Jeffrey in the later draft too, but once he was available to them, it's like, well, why not? And they had some riches at defenseman. And that's probably what made Gobrecht, you know, movable. But like you said, they had pretty much four starting defenders on their roster and were able to move one of them, to kind of, you know, clear things up a little bit, fill another need, and return the Water Dogs also, you know, pretty much have their starting three now with Burns, Randall, and Gobrecht. So, I thought that was a great trade. I think it worked out for both teams. And that kind of led to another ripple effect, though, with the chaos, which you kind of called out. So let's talk about that moment where Coach Towers mentioned why you get paid the big bucks.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly my favorite soundbite of the night. But, I mean, I had Trainer pegged there. He's a great pickup for the Archers, I think, in terms of having a two-way guy. You look at the rest of that midfield. Mazone is really the only guy that can maybe go two ways. Everybody else is kind of a clear offense or defense guy. So giving them a little bit more versatility kind of between the arcs. And so, you know, then Chaos is just kind of sitting there and it's like, well, you know what, you know, screw it. I might as well just do this now. And also just, you know, prevent the inevitable of Bernhardt falling to Stags and the whip stakes and having him, you know, take that pick. And so I think, you know, once Trainer got the rug kind of got pulled out from underneath of Towers, who's sitting there assuming Water Dogs are going to take a defenseman, seeing Trainer on the board. And then once the trade happens and then it goes, it's like, all right, fine. I'm gonna do it. Yeah. I'm gonna do it. And so it was one of those moments where I'm like, this seems, you know, like I had it projected, and it was just kind of like, all right, fine. If you're gonna take him, then I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna take Bernhardt, and I'm gonna take the risk. I'm not gonna let the whip snakes draft him, and you know, any other needs that I've got, you know, I'll try to fill later, because it might be a little bit more of a stretch, kind of past Trainer in terms of kind of a plug and play.
Yeah, no, and they filled I think a need at defense with Kyle Thornton, who's no slouch too. So
yeah, they still got their guy. They still got the guy that they needed defensively for sure.
And you know, we saw Coach Towers take a guy in last year's draft too that was potentially returning to school. Obviously, this is a little different situation with Bernhardt returning to play football, but in Jeff Teat. Now, he lost Jeff Teat's rights because of the rules, but let's talk a little bit about Jeff Teat, who, you know, him and Michael Sowers was probably the biggest debate of the night, who was going number one. I think, you know, the writing was on the wall that the Atlas were going to take Teat number one overall, but talk about those two players' games and what they bring to the pro game. I think it's going to be a discussion we're going to be having for a long time. I think both players ended up at the right spot, but you know, I think that debate of Teat or Sowers is going to be going on for a long time. So talk about both their players' games.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you look at Teat, you got drafted number one overall in the NLL, right? Mm-hmm. So what have there been, like three guys total?
Only three other guys. Yeah, Crowley and Lyle Thompson. Yep.
So I think you just look at him, and I think one of the biggest things, and I try to touch on this, but given the limited airtime, like, he's going to be a full-time professional lacrosse player, right? I mean, he's the number one overall pick in the NLL. He's going one or two in the PLL. So he's going to be playing professional lacrosse for seemingly a long time. And that's going to be it. And you look at his past performance, you know, forget about college. Like, he played against grown men in the World Games and lived up to it. I mean, he was what their leading scorer. So, you know, he has proven himself to be able to produce at the absolute highest level against, you know, the best athletes of the world. And then I think you kind of couple that with, you know, the makeup of their team and also just them being a little bit more maybe in flux in terms of what they're going to do stylistically. And he just gives them kind of a lot of options. You know, I look at Sowers and, you know, obviously he's capable of playing in the indoor. You know, he wasn't number one overall pick. But, you know, I would imagine given some of the due diligence, it just is like, okay, if he's not going to play indoor and he's just going to play outdoor, you know, does he have the same longevity? I would hope so. Certainly, you know, hoping that to be the case. And obviously there's some biases here given his former college, still an alma mater, the Tigers here. And I think you look at his fit on the Atlas as being kind of the go-to guy. On the Water Dogs. And they bogged down, you know, quite a bit offensively last year, kind of in the 6-on-6. And more specifically, you know, they just didn't have a guy that you're like, hey, can you just go generate something? Like, can you go make something happen? Like, we have something late in the shot clock. Just can you beat your man and create a shot, whether it's for yourself or for somebody else? And I think, you know, arguably nobody else in the draft, whether it's a short stick or a long pole matchup, like, just throw that out the window. Just like, can you beat your guy and create a shot? Just given his quickness, and his vision, he just makes everybody else in the field deadly. And he really unlocks a lot of their off ball play. And they've got, you know, a bevy of kind of off ball options. And so I think he's a really natural fit there. And being able to just kind of insert, you know, from day one and just being like, here's the ball, kid, go make something happen.
Yeah.
And so I think both teams kind of walked away happy. It's going to be a fun debate that we're going to have, and we're going to see, you know, what the production looks like out of these two. We're going to see how their teams perform, and it's going to be kind of a fun media debate for sure. I mean, they're going to be kind of, you know, forever linked, you know, at least for one season, but kind of beyond that. So I think the debate though probably revolved around kind of that fit and that longevity piece would be my assumption for the coaches.
Yeah, no, and I think it worked out better too for both teams. And, you know, the Water Dogs, like you said, clearly need a facilitator. Now they added Ryan Brown in the offseason, who obviously is one of the best shooters in the game, if not the best. Kieran McCarroll's no slouch on the left side too. And they picked up Ethan Walker and are getting Michael Krause also, you know, coming over as well. So, you know, a lot of offensive pieces. Westberg too, didn't mention him. And Ben Reeves, if his medical commitments don't keep him. I mean, they have a lot of pieces, but like you said, they needed that one, the guy to lead that offense. And I think they got it in Sowers.
Well, that's what's crazy about like the Water Dogs trade is you kind of look at it and it's like, okay, they didn't have a second round pick, but they got Ryan Brown. So it's like, if you had told Andy Copeland, like, hey, you're going to get Sowers in the first and Ryan Brown in the second, it's like, you know, you'd be hard pressed to find two guys that don't complement each other as well, you know, kind of on top of that. So, you know, I think you look at Sowers and just surrounding him with shooters and guys that are constantly moving off ball, you know, his chemistry with Ryan Brown is going to be something that I'm certainly be keeping a keen eye on for sure.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And then just to kind of wrap up the draft, I want to get some of your maybe biggest surprises, maybe a player that fell a little bit later that you thought was a steal, or even maybe a player that went undrafted that you're thinking maybe might get a chance to make a roster, you know, off the player pool.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking, you know, down my list right now, and like, you know, I always kind of start at the top, you know, kind of the fact that the whips are coming out of this with Kirst and with Tierney, it's kind of like, really? Like, you know, so they needed some depth in the midfield position. You know, I think Kirst, you know, for them at what, pick seven?
Seven, yeah.
Yeah, like, you know, he was my number one midfielder in terms of on my board. Like, the guy's got range. He now gives them another two-point threat. If he gets short stick matchups, like, he can dodge, shoot from a shelf. He's got unbelievable physicality to him and then really underrated vision. So I think he's going to be a really good feeder. And then Tierney brings a dynamic to that offense that they just didn't have. So, you know, a guy that is – you know, super, super creative, and is going to beat you in some ways that you're not really accustomed to defensively. And if he's also getting a short stick matchup, you know, for him to be able to kind of get his hands free and just kind of let it fly before a slide even occurs, I think he's going to be a really, really interesting dynamic to look, you know, within that offense, just a different flavor and a different look. You know, they tend to be a little bit more system driven. And I think he's just going to give them something that's unique and dynamic that and this is just another thing that teams are going to have to prepare for, you know, when they play the whips. You know, I think looking kind of towards the later rounds, I think, you know, Tanner Cook at the Chaos, that was a bit of a steal.
Perfect slot too. I feel like I honestly couldn't picture him on another team. I think, you know, obviously the Canadian influence is there, but you know, that's where I think the Chaos had a bigger need too at midfield.
The other one was Bertrand to the Redwoods.
Yeah.
That was like, you know, that was, I think, you know, in terms of third round, last pick of the third round, right? You know, I think what he brings to them, almost like akin to what Tierney's going to bring to the whips, you know, Bertrand, I just think what he's going to bring to the Redwoods is just something that they, it's just another guy that can create his own shot, you know, and you look at the upgrade that team has seen this offseason and the offensive firepower that they're going to kind of roll out. So, you know, what do you do when you got Bertrand, Jones, and Henningberg on the field? Right. And
RP3 behind that X.
So, you know, you're talking about, okay, so you're going to, if you pull logic would prevail that you're going to pull, you know, Jones or Henningberg, right? So you're looking at a short stick on Bertrand, and I just think that he is, you know, got the capabilities to initiate from a lot of different positions. Mm-hmm. He just brings so much to the table and doesn't take a lot off of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So his versatility and what he's going to provide to that offense, I thought that was, you know, a total steal for the Redwoods. So again, credit Nat, who's got a real propensity to kind of find some gems in the later rounds.
No, I agree. I actually had a mock owner of the Whipsnakes in the second round. I was surprised he fell out of the second round even. And that might've been a little bit low, but the fact that the Redwoods got him, you know, last pick of the third round was big. And then finally to wrap up, I think a position group that, you know, maybe saw a lot of love in this draft, but maybe people were kind of scratching their heads that so many guys went was the faceoff position. Talk a little bit about how the PLL, you know, really makes teams need multiple faceoff guys to throw out there at the stripe.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's like there's top heavy and then the rest is kind of this kind of mishmash, kind of like wash, if you will. Like, I don't know how much, if one guy went to the other team, you know, like how much of a significant impact that would make. So I think what teams without that clear kind of top guy, it's kind of like, well, we probably need to have some, you know, need to be multiple here. So that way we can kind of throw some different options, try to wear guys down, get guys caught on the field. And then if you do have a top guy, you need depth just in case something happens. So, you know, you look at the Whips last year, you know, with Nardella, you know, they didn't really have another guy kind of waiting in the wings. And, you know, God forbid something had happened, you know, plan B was like, you know, there wasn't a plan B. It was like break glass in case of emergency. So I think, you know, what a lot of teams, you know, elected to do was kind of, if I have a top guy, you know, I want to have a guy as a number two that just in case something happens, I've got kind of a viable option. Mm-hmm. If I don't have a top guy, then I kind of need an equal number two. So that way I can try to throw out different styles and try to wear down, you know, whomever the other team's top guy is.
No, absolutely. And we talked to Greg Renly a little bit, and it was the importance of the wing play too. And just a guy that can be versatile, that can kind of, you know, it's like a chess match almost at the stripe. It's not necessarily, you know, brute force or quick speed. It's trying to figure out how they can match up against their opponent. So yeah, I thought it was very interesting. And I wasn't too surprised after talking to Greg that many faceoff guys went, but I know a lot of people didn't think there'd be that many faceoff men off the board.
I think what's crazy about that is you look back to the expansion draft and the fact that Cannons took three guys, right?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. We're not really banking on the draft. Like, let's get through three veterans, and three proven professionals, and let's figure it out from there. Like, we don't want to like leave this to chance. And obviously, you know, with the college rules, it's becoming, you know, arguably even more challenging to evaluate that position in terms of how someone would project to the professional level. So, you know, they didn't want to even mess around with that at all.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And yeah, and I think people are scratching their heads, but it also put all the other teams kind of on notice to like, all right, well, now we really got to fill the need. Like, I don't think three teams thought they were going to lose one of their faceoff guys. And it happened.
Yeah. Well, that's a great point. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's take a quick break. We'll hear a word from our sponsor, and then we'll dive into our 5 and 5 segment. Today's episode is sponsored by Ducan Supply Co. Ducan is a men's body care brand that features an array of military-inspired products, from their signature big-ass bar of soap to their bourbon-infused beard oil. I personally use their Big Bourbon Beard Oil that is made with a hint of Buffalo Trace. I like the oak barrel scent that it gives off, and it makes me feel good about my beard, even if it's not as nice as the one that Adam's sporting these days. As an Army Reservist, I also love that they donate a portion of their proceeds to U.S. veterans. So go ahead and check out Ducanon, use our code LAX10 to receive 10% off your order, and find your own signature scent.
Welcome back to Pro Lacrosse Talk on the Lacrosse Playground Podcast Network.
All right, so welcome back. Let's dive into our 5 and 5. We'll start off with the lacrosse questions. And usually we ask people what their routines or superstitions are before games when they're going to play. But I'll ask you, what do you kind of do to prepare before you are on the broadcast booth?
So it's pretty extensive. I actually wrote an article for the PLL Island book, but, you know, obviously there's creating my board, so making sure that, you know, all the players, positions, appropriate stats, kind of all that's kind of ready to go, understanding lines, things of that nature. So that's kind of the homework, if you will, just making sure that that's kind of done. And there's no kind of shortcuts there. You just gotta kind of do it. But in doing so, it becomes pretty ingrained. Fortunately for me, with PLL rosters and with the same teams, it becomes a little bit easier, as opposed to kind of bouncing from PLL is a little bit easier as opposed to college, where I got to bounce from team to team and kind of figure out, 40 guys as opposed to kind of half that. And then from there, I try to talk to all the coaches leading up, from week to week. Obviously having a conversation with each one can prove a little bit challenging. So, sometimes priorities will be depending on which games on, which network. And then, game film, in terms of, watching games, and just like I was as a player, just trying to pick up on trends, such that I can anticipate either, individual players and what they like to do, or kind of more team and kind of macro strategies. And then from there, it's, preparing the broadcast team for, what are certain things that we need to be ready for, whether it's a certain narrative and getting kind of beyond the game, and maybe it's a player in his hometown, for example, which is kind of an easy and kind of superficial one, to also maybe matchups we need to look for. Maybe it's some trends that we need to keep our eyes on from a statistical standpoint, so that's such that we can kind of back up the eye test with what the data is showing. Kind of a multi-layered approach, kind of if you will, in terms of that preparation.
No, that makes sense. And, making sure that you guys have graphics built too for things you're going to talk about and stuff. Number two, what has been your favorite tour stop so far? Obviously you guys only toured in 2019, and then you were in Utah last year, but
what is your favorite tour stop? I'm going back a couple of years here. Baltimore is always nice just because I get to go home and see my family, and after the game, kind of my nieces and nephews were kind of running around. Selfishly, Red Bull was fantastic just because that was a quote unquote home game for me, so I could sleep in my own bed and just kind of go there the morning and kind of come back afterwards. Philadelphia was fantastic just because the crowd I thought was amazing. Albany was right there at the top. The crowd was super engaged, and that was also a blast. San Jose, I spent some extra time in San Francisco and the Bay Area kind of beforehand, and had a little bit of a vacation before a baby moon, I guess it's called. We had a little vacation before my wife gave birth. So there was a lot kind of along the way that were I'm probably missing one or two. So my apologies. I'm like knocking a city right now, but going back 2 years, I don't know, was it four or five cities? So hopefully I brought up some good memories.
Yeah, no, and a lot of them you guys are going back to too. San Jose has been one that a lot of people have brought up as just, a kind of a hidden gem that they didn't expect to be so great. Number three, who's been one of your toughest players to face during your career? So one of your toughest matchups.
From a collegiate standpoint, John Glatzel at Syracuse certainly really comes to mind. Professionally, I always loved kind of battling against Lee Zink. That was somebody that was, pure mind. Likewise with Chris Pasadena. Jack Reed was always a fun matchup. Those are some guys that just kind of immediately come to mind in terms of going toe-to-toe with.
Awesome. And then number four, who's a teammate or fellow lacrosse player that you kind of leaned on as a mentor during your career?
As a mentor? I think Roy Colsey is somebody, it was a salty veteran when I got drafted by Philadelphia. Everybody kind of endearingly calls him Uncle Roy. and he would always have kind of old war stories and take us down kind of memory lane. And, came really close to Brian Dougherty. Kyle Sweeney's more of my peer, but I've always leaned on him for kind of advice and mentorship. And, in the indoor game, I got drafted to San Jose, and, Jim Moss and Shaden Santos and were two guys that really I leaned on heavily in terms of getting their advice and kind of acclimating me. Kurt Malowski, Mouse, Patty Merrill. Those are kind of a handful of guys that come to mind kind of right off the bat.
Awesome. And then number five, which MLL championship would you say was the most satisfying? I know you had four, and that's kind of a loaded question, but which one was the one that you were really proud of?
I mean, I think my first one, I didn't know what the heck was going on. you know, I think probably the two barrage, not my first, not my last, the two barrage, I think were so notable just because, you know, after we won my rookie year, the team kind of got gutted. Mm-hmm. And we traded away a bunch of people. There was an ownership change. We like changed our uniforms and we went from like last place, like back down to, or first place, back down to last place. It was like, what is happening right now? Mm-hmm. So I think like climbing kind of back up and kind of being a little bit of the bad news bears of the league to a degree. You know, those are certainly some special moments and you know, just a special group of players as well. Not to take anything away from the first one and the last one in terms of, you know, bringing a title back to Boston. But, you know, I think that those two championships and those two teams, you know, like you said, was a dynasty.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now moving on to the off the field questions. What are some hobbies or activities that you enjoy doing when you're not covering lacrosse or coaching?
Yeah. So my social life largely revolves around food. Mm-hmm. So whatever I'm eating next, whether I am going out to eat or I'm preparing that for myself and my family. So food is a huge, huge passion of mine. Kind of started when I was in college throwing like dinner parties, and really kind of waking up and going to bed, like thinking about what I'm going to cook or eat the next day. Mm-hmm. So I would say kind of the food world is probably my biggest hobby outside of lacrosse.
That segues into my next one is, what is your favorite meal and do you prefer to dine out and cook at home?
So I play this game, Deathbed Meal, and my version is a multi-course meal. So you're not limited to one thing. You get an appetizer, entree, and dessert and an accompanying beverage.
I love it.
I haven't played this in a while, but I would undoubtedly start with some sort of, and this is also a cheat, some sort of seafood tower. So just a huge thing of oysters, shrimp cocktail, some sort of crab involved, whether it's crab salad or crab cakes or
crab balls. Roots are coming through.
shrimp cocktail, raw oysters, you know, maybe a little lobster. So a seafood tower is undoubtedly on the table at my last meal. So I will spare you the entree and dessert. But there will be some sort of seafood tower involving raw oysters amongst other things from the ocean.
I love it. As a, you know, a son of two Baltimore natives and then somebody that is now living near the Jersey Shore, I'm a big seafood guy. So that sounded amazing right now. And now I'm really hungry. So.
Right? I mean, seafood tower is the ultimate cheat code of an appetizer.
Because it could be an entree in itself.
Well, you know, like what's the combo platter of like mott sticks and like potato skins? Like, no. Like the best combo ever is the seafood tower.
Absolutely. And then number three, what is your favorite spot to vacation?
Favorite spot to vacation? It's been a while. So, you know, I naturally kind of always lean on like, what's the last spot that I went to? And usually what's the last international spot that I went to? We got to kind of travel around, you know, France for a bit. We had a wedding in Champagne. And so we went out and kind of started in Paris and then kind of rented a car and kind of cruised around a bunch of different spots, you know, went to the wedding in Champagne and then went back to Paris. And so I will lean on that trip. And you know, we stayed at this really cool little kind of like, not even resort, but like, I don't know how to describe it. But
chateau or something.
It was like out in the country and it was like, it was like a hotel run by like a restaurateurs though. And so there was like no locks, there was no Wi-Fi. The kitchen, like you just like the chef and people that were running it were like, we're going to bed. And we were like, oh, does that mean we need to go to bed? They're like, no, you're adults. You can just stay here. Like, what? Like, it was just so foreign, you know?
Yeah.
It was like, yeah. Like if you want another glass of wine, like, go grab a glass of wine. Like if you want the fire to keep going, like put another log on the fire. Like when you go to bed, make sure you put the fire out. Like,
yeah.
It was just so like foreign. But that was that was a special trip. And so I would probably lean on that.
Awesome. And then number four, who's a player in another sport that you enjoy watching right now?
Besides Steph. so, you know, Steph is, you know, certainly a blast to watch. Mm-hmm. You love watching the NBA. So I'd probably, in terms of knee jerk reaction, and I know this is supposed to be the quick hitters, you know, I'll go Steph.
Awesome. Yeah. Splash Brothers there on the Golden State Warriors. Number five, what's a book or podcast that you have read or listened to, or a TV show that you've binged that you'd recommend to somebody?
So in terms of TV shows, I'm trying to think of some. I just did The Mandalorian. I enjoyed
that. That's a good one. Yeah.
Ted Lasso. I really enjoyed Ted Lasso. That was fun and quick and kind of like good. The Undoing was, it was okay. Kind of let me down at the end. So, I would probably go there. Books-wise, the last book I read wasn't, I don't think I would necessarily recommend, but I'm just getting back into the culture game. We have a little one at home running around, so for a while there wasn't really much consumption of anything. But I guess early in quarantine, Last Dance, if you haven't watched that, I don't know,
phenomenal.
I don't know if you're like a human being or sports fan, you haven't watched The Last Dance, but if you haven't watched that, like, you know, sprint, don't run, don't walk, like sprint to your television or iPad or whatever and consume that immediately.
Check it out. Yeah. I need to check out Ted Lasso. I've heard good things about that.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Yeah. So I really like him too. Final question.
Horseman. I loved BoJack Horseman.
I heard that show's kind of deep too. Like
it's dark.
Yeah.
It's dark. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, Parks and Rec always takes me to a happy place.
Yeah.
I realize that's not new or anything, but yeah, I don't know if I'm the person right now to ask about
I think you gave some good recommendations right there. To wrap up, that wraps up our 5 and 5, but final question before I let you go, what is some advice that you have for a young player looking to play lacrosse professionally one day?
For a young player looking to play professionally, I'd really just immerse yourself and you know, watch games. There's more games and more film than really ever imaginable. And find a player that you kind of aspire to be, or somebody that you kind of project to, whether it's for whatever reason you're kind of attracted to. Maybe it's, you know, physical similarities, and just watch them and try to pick up some things from them and study them and kind of the not only the what they do but kind of why they're doing it. You know, take that and kind of mold your game kind of around that and have your own personality, but have an inspiration, have a muse, have somebody that you kind of acclimate to or inspires you that allows you to kind of take your game to the next level.
Awesome. No, I think that's some great advice. Well, Ryan, we appreciate it. We look forward to seeing you in the booth this upcoming summer and watching the PLL season this summer.
Thanks for having me.
Today's episode is sponsored by Ducan Supply Co. Ducan is a men's body care brand that features an array of military-inspired products, from their signature big-ass bar of soap to their bourbon-infused beard oil. I personally use their Big Bourbon Beard Oil that is made with a hint of Buffalo Trace. I like the oak barrel scent that it gives off, and it makes me feel good about my beard, even if it's not as nice as the one that Adam's sporting these days. As an Army Reservist, I also love that they donate a portion of their proceeds to U.S. veterans. So go ahead and check out Ducanon, use our code LAX10 to receive 10% off your order, and find your own signature scent.